birdie to win the Open.
New Zealand has another major champion.
22 seconds. At the end of a wild week, with a penalty heard and seen around the golf world, no penalty for a ball that was never found, dusty fairways and a string of 62s, it took Ryan Fox all of 22 seconds from the time Sam Burns picked his ball out of the cup to stroke that winning putt and become the champion golfer of the year. What a fascinating 4 days it was at Royal Birkdale Golf Club in Southport, England, where the end of the 2026 Major Championship golf season came to a rapid conclusion with that 12-foot birdie putt by Ryan to lay claim to the historic Claret Jug. With thanks to NBC Sports for that call and terrific presentation of the 154th Open, Kelly Elpin here, along with our executive producer, Jenna Self, welcoming you back to Musings on Golf. And we do look back today at the 154th Open and ahead to our special guest today, Rich Poggi, whose book, Fairways and Greens, a novel, is a terrific read and really speaks to directly with that title to what Ryan Fox did on the 72nd hole at Royal Birkdale, hardest hole on the golf course, the hole of his life, as it turned out, though. Great drive. 9-iron to 12 feet, knocked it in. What a story, Ryan Fox. And in a year when all four major champions were in their 30s, Ryan being the oldest at 39, and all four major championships very much earned. Rory McIlroy at the Masters, Wyndham Clark at the U.S. Open, putt after putt after putt he made. The month before with Aaron Rye, down the stretch at Aronimink to win the PGA Championship. And for a third generation of incredibly talented sportsmen to have Ryan Fox prevail at Royal Birkdale, it's a great story. His grandfather, Merv, he was a cricket captain for New Zealand, considered one of the best Kiwi batters of all time in that sport. His dad, Grant, a member of the famous All Blacks team that won the very first Rugby World Cup. His dad was inducted into the World Rugby's Hall of Fame in 2014. Ryan didn't even turn pro until he was 25. Won three times on the PGA Tour of Australasia. Won four times on the DP World Tour, including the 2023 BMW PGA Championship. And in that year, 2023, that's where he gained temporary status on the PGA Tour. And obviously, his victory at Royal Birkdale being the highlight by far of his career. 60 years after the first New Zealander, Sir Bob Charles, won the Open at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's, also in England. Michael Campbell was the second Kiwi to win a major golf championship at the 2005 U.S. Open at Pinehurst number 2. Lydia Ko has won three times, three majors, and just a terrific player for many years on the LPGA Tour. It does, as I said, put a bow on the major championship golf season for 2026. Each of the four majors is unique, right? And the Open Championship, with baked out fairways this year because of so little rain over there in England, every hole seemed to be, you're hitting, you know, with very little grass to play from, yet the golf course held up so well. What a great, great challenge Royal Birkdale is. And good for Ryan Fox in terms of pace of play and getting to the ball and hitting the ball and not slowing down. You've got too many Patrick Cantlays in the world, too many human rain delays that I think are very bad for the game of golf. And doggone, if Ryan Fox didn't show that, yep, get up to your ball, you can, I mean, heck, was it literally right after Sam Burns, who has come so incredibly close to winning major championships, the U.S. Open last year, the U.S. Open this year, this Open Championship, after he picks his ball out of the cup, I mean, as I said, 22 seconds later, that putt is on its way. There's no aim point and all this other stuff that has become a regular nuisance, in my opinion, on the PGA Tour and in the world of golf. and knocked it right in the hole. Take a quick look at some of the other things from the week. Okay, the Bryson DeChambeau situation, a lot of different views on it. I think the RNA made the right decision on it. I had the good fortune of playing at Royal Birkdale last year. I hit my ball several times, not surprising, into that junk that he hit into. Yeah, you just, first of all, to be able to find it is a pretty good thing. Number two is you just got to be careful around that. And he clearly was not of a nature of being, I don't think he did it on purpose, but he wasn't focused on the area behind the ball. I do think he improved his angle of the shot, his line of the shot. Now, I never saw that on TV. I thought Smiley Kaufman of NBC Sports and Golf Channel did a really good job when he went out there and sort of, you know, showed exactly what was going on or where it took place. And again, it was way off the beat path. And I don't know that there was a person out there. There's typically a rules person who's assigned to every hole or every major championship. I don't know if there's anybody out there. And so however it came to the RNA's attention, I think that they made the right choice. I also think that the protest, they'll protest too much. Come on, Bryson DeChambeau. I mean, it was just over the top, in my opinion. It kind of goes back, folks. Maybe I'm a bit old school. Maybe Janice Self and I, we were talking about this before. Maybe we're a little old school, but that's okay. I just think there's a way that you conduct yourself. You take what you know. Rory McIlroy said it was performative. A lot of people would call what some things that Rory McIlroy has done as performative, and they're not wrong. But I think in this case, and with the whole notion of I'm not sure if I'm even going to play tomorrow and hitting all these balls until 10 o'clock at night and the RNA not able to put out the parries for the next day, it was not the way that a professional at his level should conduct himself. The situation with the temporary immovable obstruction on Sunday with Scottie Scheffler on 17, where he hit a second shot in the par five, way, way left of that corporate area. Obviously the rule was in play there that any ball that landed, and it landed left of that thing, any ball that deemed to be in that area is you get a free drop. And what a free drop that was. I mean, instead of looking like a complete catastrophe, he ends up making birdie on the hole and almost gets it to nine iron or to nine under. But Scottie Scheffler just missed too many putts. He just didn't make anything. What it mattered on Saturday, put himself in a bad situation going into Sunday, and he goes 0 for 4 with the major championships. I mentioned Sam Burns. His wife gave him the okay after they had their newest a child, and he just hope. I remember, our late great friend Bob Buck thought about Bob a lot last week with the Open Championship, and Bob, people would always say, well, you know, so-and-so didn't get it done, but he'll get it done at some point. He'll get that major. Bob would always like, I think it's guaranteed. You don't know. And I wonder, I hope I'm wrong about Sam Burns. I hope I'm wrong about Cameron Young as well. I mean, Cameron Young, I was at the Masters this year. He had that tournament early into the final round. He let it get away from him. He got beat by Rory McIlroy. But Cameron Young, it was a sad scene on the range and waiting to see if he'd make it into a playoff. And he hears the roar and he knew it was over. It was interesting for both Ryan Fox and Cameron Young getting congratulatory notes from Jack Nicklaus. And Jack's no dummy when it comes to marketing his property. Both Cameron Young and Ryan Fox are members at the Bears Club here in Palm Beach Gardens, or in Jupiter, not far from where I live. So Jack, yes, was congratulating them both, but also putting in a nice plug for his very, very special golf course. So congratulations goes out to Ryan Fox. Let's hear from Ryan Fox. Hey, Ryan, how does it feel to be the champion golfer of the year?
It's surreal, to be honest. I mean, it's something you dream of. You know, I used to get up in the middle of the night to watch this tournament back home. And, you know, it was always something that was there just to be able to play in it first up. And, you know, now to be an Open champion, to be the champion golfer of the year, it's, yeah, unbelievable, surreal, crazy. I don't have enough words in my vocabulary to explain it, to be honest.
And it had to be just a a remarkable feeling. And if you watched the phone call he had with his wife and kids afterwards, very emotional. Too bad that they weren't there. But as I said, he's a worthy champion. He deserved it. And let's hope that Ryan Fox continues to play well for many years to come. Okay, Rich Poggi. Rich Poggi has written a terrific book, Fairways and Greens, a novel. I like the book a lot. This is an interesting guy, more than 30 years of experience in tech sales and leadership. But Poggi has also built a wide-ranging freelance writing career, spanning network sports television, late-night comedy, stand-up, speech writing, a lot of new media, very proud, lifelong resident of Westwood, New Jersey. And the book, I reached out to Rich, interviewed him last week. And I think you're really going to enjoy the interview. I said, okay, Rich, if you can give me a couple paragraphs to sort of describe the book. And here's what he said. He said, once destined for PGA Tour stardom, Earl Parker's career was derailed by injury and his own self-destruction. Returning to the New Jersey Golf Club where he grew up, he quietly rebuilt his life as a respected golf professional. Years later, life at Windsor Hills Golf Club is exactly where Doug wants to be as he fights to protect the club and its traditions in a rapidly changing world. Then a phone call from his past changes everything. What follows is a character-driven story of family, rediscovery, and second chances, all set against a game that has a way of revealing the truth about people when it matters most. It's a really good read. Fairways and Greens, a novel. It's his first long-form book, if you will. It did a really good job with it. Rich Poggi, and encourage you to read it. You're going to like this interview a lot. A lot of personality to him, a lot of personality to the book, and a lot of other things that we'll talk about. He played college sports, fascinating guy. You'll hear that right after you hear from our friends at William and Harry Golf and the Friars Golf Club. And please, folks, remember, subscribe and like us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcast. Rich Poggi, Fairways and Greens, a novel, right after these words. Our friends at William and Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William and Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work. Planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. Fairways and greens. It's a mantra in golf that denotes order and consistency from a game that challenges such ideals on a regular basis. And for our special guest today, those three words are at the foundation of his terrific work of fiction with meanings that extend far beyond the golf course itself. And it may even have to do with a novel that he's written. What a pleasure to welcome to Musings on Golf the author of Fairways and Greens, a novel, Rich Poggi. I love what you've done with this book. How are you?
Well, I appreciate it, Kelly. It's been quite the journey, you and I finally getting together.
It has been.
I appreciate, you having me, with Urlacher, and I think you had John Bodenhammer on, and Freddie Funk.
Yeah.
Great one. I love with Jan Stevenson, my guy, Mark Canizzaro. I hope I don't tank your ratings, but thanks for having me.
Oh, not at all. You're going to be right up there with those guys. And we've got, by the time this is on, we'll have had Jim Kant as well, which I know you're excited about. But the focus on the book, I got to tell you what, I was very fortunate, Rich, to be with the PGA of America for a dozen years and background in writing. So I have great appreciation for guys like you, women like you, who endeavor and go into writing a book of any length, and particularly what you've done with this one. Talk a little bit, please, about, I mean, particularly with your background. You're not necessarily a professional writer per se. 30 years of experience in tech sales and leadership. You have done a lot of freelance writing. But why this novel? What spurred this on? And particularly this novel about a golf professional, his dad, and in the case of Fairways and Greens, the golf club that's really been about their whole lives.
Sure. Well, and my day job hasn't been writing, but I've always written way back to high school. And then through my career, there were, little dalliances where I tried to do it full time. But, having been successful in sales, it was, all about the money and then families and, life getting away, having kids, which was all good. But that side hustle always remained. So Fairways and Greens actually started as a script. At the time, late 90s, early 2000s, I had been doing a bunch of stuff in television, again, all freelance, and had made some great relationships. And one of them was with a guy who liked a script that we got pretty far. It had nothing to do with golf. And we're at lunch one day, and he basically said to me, I was with Michael Douglas over the weekend, and all the guy did was talk about golf. Yeah. And I remembered Michael being on Letterman, talking about his love of golf, looking for a project for him and his dad, Kirk, who was still alive back then. And I just threw out there, I said, I got a golf script. If I clean it up, it's only a treatment. Would you show it to Michael? And he's like, yeah. So I got on a train back to New Jersey and realized I had nothing. So I had the couple of little hooks. I had golf, I had fathers and sons. And then I sat down and I started coming up with something over the course of the next couple of weeks, got it to treatment form. And like anything else, Michael moved overseas with Catherine Zeta-Jones, who was very hot back then. And my guy went on the West Coast, opened up a new restaurant, and it just sat for years and years and years. And then after a little personal stuff that my wife and my family and our community went through, a real impactful loss, I just kind of looked at my life differently and changed industries, played a lot of golf, and said, I'm on the back nine of my life, my career. It's time to get back to writing. And it was easy but this was a no-brainer, adapting a script into the novel, became Fairways and Greens, a novel. So that's kind of the genesis of it all.
That's fascinating. So how do you go about creating those characters that are in the book, developing them? And I'm, you being a very proud guy from New Jersey, you're a product, you live in Westwood, New Jersey, you play it at Rivervale Country Club. It's been your home your entire life. You're a big part of the community where you've lived. There has to be some semblance, Rich, people in those characters. So it's a multi-part question.
Yeah.
How do you who are these characters? How do you develop them? And how much of the of real people are in those characters that are in the book?
So first of all, New Jersey is I was born in Brooklyn. My parents moved there when I was very young. I said I had a couple formula in Brooklyn, but most Italian people are from Brooklyn ultimately. But New Jersey is my home. I'm a Jersey guy. High school sports, all that stuff. I still live in New Jersey. My kids are born in New Jersey. They were, they're still in New Jersey. So the first thing is you got to write what you know, right? So, so much of Fairways and Greens, the script that became the novel, is my life, where I hang out, even the names of the bars and restaurants, to a certain degree, the characters. From the perspective of Doug, who's the main protagonist, the golf pro, and his father, Douglas, we call him Parker Sr., you know, there was a little bit of, you know, keeping in mind Michael Douglas and his father in that to start, per se.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But you know, Doug and his father are true examples of what you saw in your work at the PGA of America, right? They're master teaching professionals. They do the right thing, totally ethical, and so on and so forth. So Doug is a composite character of every golf pro I've ever taken a lesson from or known. Yep. He's similar in age to me. Parker Sr. is, you know, more of a curmudgeon type guy, old school, you know, still wears the plus fours, a big Hogan guy. And I know so many of those guys that are wisecracking old guys that, you know, throwbacks. So those two were kind of easy. But then I took some stuff from, like I said, I knew I wanted to do something about fathers and sons, but I didn't want it to be derivative. You know, Fairways and Greens is different than most books or, you know, if it ever got made into a movie, conceits, because it's not about winning, right? It's about relationships. It's about things that professional golfers go through in their lives. So, you know, I have a subplot in there of, you know, a Corn Ferry Tour player living in the shadow of his father, John Carter. And yep. That comes right from Gary Nicklaus and Jack Nicklaus, right? You know, what would have happened if Gary Nicklaus doesn't lose to Mickelson in that playoff all those years ago? Or, you know, Kevin Stadler, he won a couple of times, you know, but then he lost in a couple of playoffs. So, you know, and living in his father's shadow. And Bill Haas was on a run until he had that tragedy in his life. So I had that. So I just started to build the story. And, you know, you have to write what you know. So it's all about New Jersey, you know, the composite golf courses and everything else. And anywhere I could inject something in that's part of my life, I did. And everything else was just the nature of storytelling.
Rich Poggi joining us here on Musings on Golf. His terrific book, Fairways and Greens, a novel, is available through Amazon and at bookstores. Tell me about the club a little bit as well. It's in the book. And you also have a number of women who play key roles in the book.
Sure. So the club, again, is a composite. I play Rivervale. That's my home course. It's a semi-private club in Rivervale, New Jersey. But through work and friendships, I play tons of private clubs and country clubs. I wanted it to be like, I wanted Windsor Hills to be like a mini Pine Valley. Mm-hmm. Right. It's out in West Jersey. But I wanted it to be a golf club for golfers, you know, middle, upper class, no pretentiousness. There's no pickleball courts. There's no catering hall. It's the grill room, a club, a range. And, you know, through some of their initiative, they're going to convert the old barn into a little indoor facility with a simulator just to keep up with the times. So it kind of mirrors a couple of courses I play. But it's fictitious, and I just wanted everyone to read the book to feel like they were at a course where it was all about golf and the people that play it. So that's how I came up with Windsor Hills. In terms of the women, you know, that came to me from a good buddy of mine's son who read the script. And before I started writing it, I figured, you know what, with Netflix and, you know, stuff that was happening out there, let me see if I can maybe sell it. And I asked him to read it. He's a showrunner out in California. And he said, Rich, I love it. But, you know, you got to realize you're coming out of COVID. There's 15,000 million scripts. No one's going to read it. So make it into a novel. And then at least you have the IP, which he planted the hook, Mike Iannacone Jr. Shout out to him out there in Cali. But, with that, he said, the only thing I would do is I'd make the women characters a little more powerful, a little more dominating. There, you know, a couple of them are a little subservient. And, you know, this is not 1980 or 1990.
And it comes across that way. They are.
Yeah, they're very powerful. Annie, who is like Doug's on again, off again, his partner in the pro shop and in the club. You know, they have their own little life trajectories and they find each other when they're coming out of relationships. She's type A, spunky, you know, gym every day, keeps him in line. Then he gets a visit from someone from his past who's, you know, got some things that he has to address, and we'll leave it at that and not really spoil anything. But she's a very, you know, she's strong in her own way. And then Doug just continues to meet other characters throughout the book that, you know, are maybe in his age group, and they're, you know, they're very powerful, and they get him through, you know, where he needs to get to. So it was very important to have strong female characters, which I keep not only through this book, but also in the sequel that we'll talk about another time.
And to go back to that dynamic between father and son, Rich, any dynamic between father and son has its great special moments, but it can also be very challenging in terms of how each looks at the world. I think you bring that out in this book, because the way that senior might look at things isn't always the way that the son is looking at things, and vice versa. But there's certainly a bond between the two of them at the same time.
Without question. And, you know, a lot of that parallels, you know, my relationship with my dad. Yeah. I think that Parker Sr. is a little more in tune with current times, although he likes the old school better. My father always did that. My father always hung out with us. He'd show up at games, you know, when I was in college playing football with, you know, with a case of beer and hang out all night with us. So there's a little bit of that. But within the game of golf particularly, Doug is old school, right? Doug is not really looking at TrackMan. He's definitely under his father. But that father and son relationship comes from, you know, not only what I had with my dad, but also the relationship I've built with my sons, which is, you know, be a friend first, father second, and then, you know, it's all natural stuff.
I think you and I are both lucky. My father was the head professional at a men's club in the D.C. area for 50 years, went on to become the president of the PGA of America. I had a really special relationship with my dad, and I was touched by your dedication at the start of the book to my father, Richard A. Pogge. Thank you for the life lessons, unforgettable experiences, and for handing me your set of Nicholas McGregors in 1977 and taking up running marathons. So help me out with a little bit of all that about your dad. Was the running the marathons, was that your dad, or was that what he had you ultimately get involved in?
No, I'm not a marathon guy. I'm a baseball, football guy until right. I found golf. So the story with that is, you know, I go off to play baseball one morning, and as I'm leaving, my father and my two uncles, may they rest in peace. Thankfully, my father's still alive, by the way. He's hanging in there at 88. But my right. two uncles, Phil and Johnny Boy, were there, and they're going to play golf. And I'm like, yeah. My father doesn't play golf. No, we're taking him to play golf. He's got to play golf. He's got to learn golf. I'm like, all right. So I go to the field, and, you know, this is 1977. I'm 11 years old. And you're there all day, right? So yeah. they go and play their golf. And, you know, I'm sitting in the house, and I hear the garage door open, and I go say, how's it going? And literally, Kelly, my father hands me this bag of clubs, and he says, you keep these. I'm done with this flipping sport. F-bombs, and then they're yelling at him, nah, it takes time. You got to practice. Screw this. And my father bought clubs, used them once, gave them to me, and then went back to what he really enjoyed, which was running marathons.
Wow.
And he ran marathons and half marathons from that point until he was probably 50, 55 years old.
What motivated your dad? Why? Why did he enjoy that so much?
You know, he was a good ball player, good baseball player. You know, we played on some softball teams, but he liked running, and he ran a lot. Some of it was probably to run away from my mom, who they ultimately got divorced, which was fine. And I think that she tried to put the clubs in a garage sale, but I saved them. But yeah, that was my first set of clubs. And, you know, literally, I went out. I'll never forget. I went out with them like that. As soon as I got them, I'm like, what the hell is a golf club? And I went out and I started hitting balls in the yard, and I didn't hit any of them. I missed every one. But those were the clubs I had until I started caddying, which was about 3 years later after we moved.
And the caddying, I was lucky. I caddied at my dad's club for about a dozen years. Caddying sounds like it really got you invested, embraced into the game, right?
1,000%. So, you know, when my parents divorced, which was fine, it was great for everybody. All the constituents of the divorce have done very well since.
Good.
And I'm a believer in that. I'm glad they didn't stay together. But at the end of the day, they instill the work ethic in me and, you know, had to work. And again, you know, we come from a different generation. So, you know, even my kids work, they got it through me. But back then,
yeah,
you know, my mother was like, you need money, go earn it. And I was, you know, raking ball fields. And one day I saw all my buddies that weren't playing that day on their bikes. And they came back, you know, 6 hours later, and I was still at the ball field because you had four games. You had to prepare the field. And I made my $12 and they got 25. And I'm like, where'd you guys go? And they're like, the golf course. I'm like, what golf course? There's a golf course a couple blocks away, White Beaches, about a mile away. Yeah. So sure enough, I said, I'll do that. And then I did that and I was hooked from day one. I knew a couple of the members through sports, got some good loops. And from seventh grade till the middle of high school, that's where I spent my summers, caddying at White Beaches.
And you mentioned earlier about the sports you played. You played Division III football. Mm-hmm. Where did you play? What position?
So I was a football guy in high school, a football baseball guy in high school. I was a quarterback and a free safety. And I went up to Pace University in Westchester, which had just come from D2 to D3.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was fine. I was a special teamer, got a little run at quarterback, threw too many picks, got hurt, got replaced. And I realized that I was probably better at being an H-back because I knew the offense, I could catch. And I had two great years under behind the guy who became the best quarterback in Pace history, catching some of his passes and blocking for him. It's a great way to go out. But, you know, back then it was more about the parties than the actual football.
as you said about your dad joining you for
he
for
would
some
show
this,
up.
Right?
He'd show up with a beer ball, park in the parking lot, hang out with my Uncle Johnny. And then they'd be there till 9 o'clock with us. We'd still be in our lowers and a sweatshirt. And, you know, then we'd go to Foley's. And then, you know, my father once in a while would crash on the couch.
Let's get back to Fairways and Greens, Anava, for a minute. It seems to me, as I mentioned up front, Rich Poggi, that it's about trying to pursue those goals of, you know, when you say, if I do hit fairways and greens, it's like just getting to play and knocking on the green. Way too simple. It's not way too simple, right? But it is about the pursuit of those goals. We're going to make mistakes along the way, and it that part of the dynamic between the father and son. And I sort of felt that over the course of the book.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, right. It's the relentless pursuit of better, right? We're all after in the game. And, you know, even if you miss the fairway, you know, what's the easiest way to get it back without the hero shot? You know, Doug says, you know, taking chances is overrated. But yeah, I mean, what I tried to build after I had the dynamic of the father and the son, Doug having had this PGA Tour career that he kind of crashed and burned with, but you know, it's not a redemption story. Doug's redemption was going back to Windsor Hills where he grew up and finding his purpose, right? As a teaching pro and taking over for his dad.
Yeah.
So, you know, the ups and downs of the Parkers, Doug and Douglas, is really, you know, when the mom dies, which happens well before the story, it just gets referenced. But they're dealing with folks and they're dealing with situations that are now, especially Doug, that find them in the life's rough, you know, right, Kelly? Not the rough of Windsor Hills or the golf course, but life's rough. And how does Doug use what he's learned in the game, not only to help himself navigate this, but indirectly people around him that he might not necessarily be able to come in contact with, to make par, right? How am I going to make par if I'm by a tree? And, you know, and you got to figure out a way to give yourself a putt for par in golf and life. And that's what Doug does. And I think while the story is not about winning, ultimately he wins.
Hey, Rich, I'm really enjoying this conversation about your career and Fairways and Greens, a novel. Let's take a short break, hear from our friends at William and Harry Golf, and we'll be right back to continue with our fun discussion. At William and Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William and Harry is partnering with charities to give back.
donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deer skin, calf skin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission.
How have you gone about over the years balancing that day job with what you talked about with the side? How do you do that? How do you market yourself for someone who might want to pick up writing or do something that's separate from their main job? How do you balance that? How do you do it?
You don't sleep a lot.
Yeah, great.
Number one. And, you know, what you really have to do is figure out what you want to do. Right. And it could be writing a book. It could be doing something else.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of the book came together while I wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the editing and rewriting came when I was back to finding out what I wanted to do with my life after we got through those first couple of months of that tragedy. And it's like anything else. You have to plan the work and work the plan. I do not do any writing during the day unless it's on the weekends, but I have that plan, which is my career, which is managing a large group of insurance producers at a $4 billion company, plug to Acrisure, who's been great with me. And they realize that, you know, everyone has a little side hustle in their lives, especially when you hit 60. But, you know, I don't care, Kelly, if you're building a house, a new golf swing, a sales and business pipeline,
right?
You have to, or writing a book, you have to plan the work and work the plan, throw that plan into your calendar and have discipline to go home at 6 o'clock, spend some time with your wife. You know, I used to walk my dog and spend time with my dog, but unfortunately she passed. So it's 8 o'clock. I'm at my desk. I'm working till 10:30, take a break, finish off in my bed for an hour. And that's what it comes down to. It comes down to discipline and, you know, not necessarily worrying about the outcome, but the process. And my process is that, especially now with marketing the book and writing the sequel, outside of work and, you know, a couple of rounds of golf, all I do is write.
I want to ask you about the sequel in a moment, but talk a little bit about the principles that I read about that you have. There are two guiding principles. You said one from a legendary NFL coach and the other from your English, your college English professor.
Oh, wow. You did your research.
I did. Talk about those two.
Oh, that's
really
great.
Interesting. Yeah.
So the first one's from Parcells, right? So yeah. Jersey, you know, Springsteen,
absolutely.
The Giants and, you know, Jersey Shore, right?
Yeah.
But not the Jersey Shore, the show, just going down the shore.
Right. Down the shore. That's right. I'm not going to the shore. I'm going down the shore. I know.
BTS. That's
right.
BTS. So Parcells was, you know, expect nothing, blame nobody, do something.
Yeah.
And if you subscribe to those three things,
yeah,
you know, you're going to be successful. He won two Super Bowls, right, with that. Yeah. So that's the first thing. And that is on my wall in my office. I used to have it on my computer, but I stopped. So it's expect nothing, blame nobody, do something. It's about accountability and, you know, not sitting around. You know, if you can do it on a golf course or in life, that's it. And the next thing came from Dr. Nick, who was one of my first and biggest supporters in college. He supported me. He opened a bunch of doors that led to some freelance projects. He edited a bunch of my short stories. He taught me how to craft a good joke, because I did a lot of joke writing before I started getting into more of the long form stuff. And he had a simple thing. You know, he'd say, Richie, you know, the only thing you got to do is rewrite. The practice of writing is rewriting. And, you know, when I'm done with this sequel, the first manuscript, you know, I have a soft target of like August 1. It'll be like the third version of a manuscript, because I'm constantly rewriting and rewriting. Then it'll go to my editor and then we'll look at it and say, all right, we got to lose this. You got to add this. why'd you go here? And then we'll have that discussion. That'll be another month or 6 weeks of work.
I'll tell you what, you're a good writer. The book is really well written. So before we talk about the sequel, give our listeners a sense of when they purchase the book, what do you hope that they get from Fairways and Greens, a novel? What do you want them to take away from that, Rich Poggi?
I appreciate you asking that. So we'll talk about how they can get it at the end. And if you want to talk about the sequel, that's fine. It's just an extension of the characters, which I think was very important for me to kind of take them to the next level. But what I want people, and I say this to anyone that reads the book, and I've had a lot more than most first-time authors. You know, I got a great review from Alex Myers over the Golf Digest. I'm sure you know Alex.
Yeah.
Like, Rich, I can't believe this was written by a first-time writer.
Yeah, it's really good. Really well written.
And that's the first thing. So I ask people two questions. Did it read like it was written from a first-time writer? And they say no. And I say, did it make sense and was the ending plausible? And they say yes. And I said, all right, let's talk about the book. So I want people to, whether you're a male or female, young or old, and you like to read, I want people to get into the book, feel like they're part of the story, part of the club. They know the characters. Mm-hmm. And I want them to realize that, you know, like I said earlier, Kelly, you know, there was only one Francis we met, right? Yeah. No one's coming out of the weeds here to beat Scottie Scheffler in the U.S. Open. It's not Stick, which is a lame attempt at Ted Lasso. It's not Tin Cup, although that at least does deal with, you know, golfers outside of winning and losing and some of their struggles. But I want them to say, you know what, I care about these characters, and you know, golfers go home, golf pros go home. And when they get home, they have issues. And how do they deal with them? So if we can do that and the ending becomes plausible to you, and I didn't waste your time, it's a good dalliance from, you know, whatever you're doing or that's not on Netflix to read the book.
And the sequel is, as you said, an extension of those characters. Is that what we should expect?
Yeah. So if you've read the book and you're in that club, 650, yeah. Yes. 650 and get, I'm going to get to 1,000. Trust me. I'm going to get to 1% of people who have written a book have gotten to 1,000. I'm getting to 1,000. and beyond, but yeah. So, the sequel came to me because I kind of left a couple of things open. And then literally, I didn't read the book, Kelly, until I copy edited it for the seventh time over like 2 weeks. So I was sick of the book.
Sure.
But then as people started reading it, they're like, whatever happened to that? Did you? And I said, you know, I kind of did some stuff, but I just at some point, like in February, I was actually in Florida golfing down at the Osprey, a nice public track. I was talking to somebody and I mentioned the book and he's like, you know, I really enjoyed it. What are you doing next? And I go, I think I'm going to write a sequel. He goes, you better. And I said, all right. You know, so I uncovered that women like the book, and to follow that line.
Ooh. Interesting. Yeah.
I have a whole Epson tour kind of track now with Beth, who's the pro that leaves, you know, Doug to go pursue that dream again, because he's corrected her swing after her injury. So it really goes that direction and it builds on some relationships in the book.
You know, early on, I said something that's not right. I said you're not a professional writer, and that's wrong. And I take that back. You're not a full-time professional writer. So let me clarify that. But I do congratulate you on the book. I really think it is terrific. And it's certainly, to your first question, it does not read at all like someone who's written a book for the first time. It's terrific. So let's close this.
Okay.
You know, I always get the opportunity at the end of these, Rich, to ask people about, you know, who would you play a special round of golf with? If you had three people, living or deceased, who would you go out and play with? And the answers have been really varied and interesting. For you, Rich Poggi, who would you go, who would those three be, living or deceased, and where would you go play?
All right. So I've played some great courses. You know, I've played some not great courses and thousands in between. Yeah. So I look at, you know, and I've got some great courses coming up here in New Jersey and New York. I look at my next round of golf as the best round of golf.
Love it.
And, you know, I just want to be out there. I've gotten better because I've gotten older, and I've actually, you know, said to myself, you wrote a golf book, now you got to play better. So I went, I called Michael Breed up. He's a friend of mine. And I said, Mike, I just want you to know that I have a full bag of Titleist now. He's like, you finally did it. I said, yeah, and I've gone to a mallet putter. So, you know, I'm a 9-3 index.
Yeah,
but, you know, sometimes that's a little jaded because I'm playing at not hard courses. But, you know, to net it out, any dream round I play, Kelly, is going to have me and my two sons in it.
Nice.
Period. End of story. Nick is 30, great kid, former, you know, college tackle, plays like a tackle, can hit the ball far, but has no short game, doesn't realize you got to practice a lot more. My little guy's 27. Today's actually his birthday.
Hey, that's great.
He was my quarterback, free safety. So, you know, he's a natural athlete. He could hit the ball 310 and get a 9 on a hole, right?
Right, right.
So it's going to include them. It's going to be wherever we can play. I don't need to play with them at Augusta. And then that fourth spot, I'm going to leave open for Rory. I'd love to play with, you know, obviously, if Tiger's available, he wants to play. Any guy that's one of the guys that I try and pattern myself, the way they talk, the way they communicate. But any pro golfer, Lee Trevino would be a great guy to throw in there. You know, Lee Buck, I give him a shout out in my book. So one of those guys. I've met Jack Nicklaus. He's a great guy, but obviously he's passed. And you know, his prime, as is Lee. So any major professional that I've followed, you know, I love Greg Norman back in the day until he kind of went his own way recently. Right. Yes, so one of those guys that kind of takes chances, is humble, that kind of a fourth person could join our group anytime.
Great answer. Before I ask you where people can buy the book, I mentioned it earlier, but where for you professionally, where does writing this book rank among your professional accomplishments?
Love that. So, you know, you said it earlier about the writing. So I'm a professional writer.
Yes, you are.
I'm not an author, although I wrote a book, and I don't consider myself a literary author. I try and write more as if I was writing a screenplay. So dialogue to me comes very natural. The narrative is a little bit of a struggle, but I like to paint the picture and describe stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm a writer of books. And if you call that an author, that's great. But I have some great accomplishments, you know, having, you know, written for Dave Letterman as a freelancer, you know, the late, late show, Craig Kilborn, that whole crew. I wrote for some national comedians. You know, I wrote for a guy that, you know, Steve Bridges, rest in peace. He did the correspondence dinner. He was a Bush impersonator, and he's telling some of my jokes to Bush, and Bush is laughing.
Wow.
So I never really needed, and I've also won sales awards, gone on president's clubs. But, you know, I never really needed the personal adulation. You know, seeing my kids raise a trophy at MetLife for a state championship was great. It's all about other people. I have a great wife who lets me be who I want to be. When I got the book sent to me, you know, the author copies.
Yeah.
I've read about how many people are so excited, blah, 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 blah. It really did nothing for me because it just confirmed, you know, my son and I kind of did the cover and then we sent it to the artist who made it perfect first time. But we had a little, you know, like a little AI sketch that we did and he did a great job. I was interested to see, you know, how the acknowledgments came out because they were so personal to me. Yeah. But I never really got a thrill out of, you know, opening the book. And then I did a couple of signings. I never really got the thrill. What's been the personal satisfaction is this. Meeting Kelly, meeting Janice, the stuff with Ann, you know, playing golf Monday with the, you know, the Met Golf Writer Association at Montami, hearing from people through email, the journey. You know, I the money to write the book and publish the book, Kelly, I spend that, you know, with my guys golfing in Benton and Saratoga and dinners. This is more about the journey, the people you meet, a lot like a golf round. It's who I've met, and that's what has been the most greatest satisfaction about this, has been the journey and the people I've met. from all walks of life and all over the world. The guy from Australia bought my book and sent me an email.
You talked about Ann. That's the great Ann Liguori, who is a great friend of our show. And you met her at the U.S. Open. And you US told Open. The story about, you told her about her spending time with your boys, right?
Yeah, she spent time with my boys. You know, I know Ann back the original days of FAN. You know, she's a legend. She's like the first female, you know, talk radio person. And, you know, but it was all about them. And I think that's Ann. She's bubbly. She's beautiful on the inside and out. She loves the game. Her podcasts are great. She doesn't do authors, though. She doesn't do fiction.
Right, that's right.
But she did. She did plug my book, and I plug hers on social media. She's the best. But that's it, Kelly. It's meeting Kelly Elbins, talking golf, and you know this is the goal. I mean, if it ever got anywhere else, if I made $1 million from it, it's not going to change my life. It's going into my kids' future, my future grandkids. It's not going to change my life. It's about the relationships, like anything else.
Great stuff. The book is Fairways and Greens, a novel. The author, Rich Poggi. Rich, tell our listeners where they can purchase your fine book.
Well, if you hung in with us, I appreciate it. The easiest thing to do if you want a nice memento is send me an email, rich@richpoggi.com, and I'll sign one and send it to you for the same price you'd get it or cheaper on Amazon. One of the reasons why Amazon is such a high stock is because they don't pay their authors well.
That's what I hear.
But at the end of the day, like I said, whatever I make on the book, I'll probably put into the second one. So www.richpoggi.com, richpoggi.com. If you go there, you can learn about the book, learn about me, ultimately listen to this link, and then see where you can buy it. New Jersey, you can buy it at Bookends or down the shore, Little Point Bookshop in Point Pleasant. I do signings all over the place. It's obviously available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, anywhere you can purchase a paperback or an ebook, or just send me an email. I'll sign one up, write a little note thanking you for your interest, and get it out to you via the good old United States Post Office.
Well, we thank Rich Poggi so much. It was a fun interview and a really interesting guy. Next week, talk about interesting. Talk about someone who's had a great passion for the game. Wildupagay III, who has just been chosen to receive the Paint Stewart Award, which is given annually to a PGA Tour member honoring character, sportsmanship, and charity commitments. And boy, oh boy, has Noda ever given back, particularly on the junior golf side. Very thrilled to be joined by Noda Begay III next week on Musings on Golf. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Musings on Golf as we wrap up the 2026 Major Championship golf season. Congratulations to Ryan Fox. We got to wait until April of 2027, though, for the Masters, folks. But we'll have a lot of good golf talk in between. Kelly Elbin signing off for the Dean Jenna Self here on Musings on Golf.